This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. Do you have a question for Zorba? Then give us a call right now at 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, along with our calls, some interesting research to talk over?
Yes, macho men. Are they healthy men? What do macho men think about their health, and what do they do, and do they live as long? Is it going to be macho?
Good question.
Healthy lifestyle habits actually may reduce lots and lots of things. There are the big four. We're going to start to call them the big four, and they do a massive job at a massive reduction in chronic diseases. Very important research.
Coming up later in the hour. What's our recipe?
Grilled chicken with fruit salsa. So look at that. We have one of the four basic food groups, chicken.
And one of the others, salsa.
Salsa, fruit chicken, salsa, fruit, and donuts. The four basic food groups. Anyway, it's a great recipe. Low-fat chicken, fruit, wonderful. You will love it.
Mm-hmm. And our medical myth buster coming up later in the hour. Don't forget our number, 800-462-7413. And here's a listener who's called that number, a listener in Bloomington, Indiana. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Well, first of all, let me say I'm a huge fan of your show, so thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
My question relates to tanning, and I am 40 years old, and I've tanned off and on through my life. I've had a few sunburns as a kid, but for the most part, I'm sort of dark complexed, so I don't really burn, even if I get a little pink one day in a few days. If I take care of it with lotion, it turns into a tan. And I don't typically have to use much sunscreen. At the beginning of the summer I do, and then later on it just, my skin just kind of handles the sun. And I recently went to the dermatologist and got a baseline, kind of, you know, just have him check me out, and he said very emphatically that he saw nothing on my skin to be worried about. So given all of that, I really, really am happier when I have a little sun. I don't have seasonal affective disorder or anything like that. I just am happier when I'm warm, and I think I look a lot better with a little bit of a tan. And so I wondered, what's your opinion on me using a tanning booth, not to look like spring break, but just on a semi-regular basis, just to kind of keep my skin warm.
Okay, well, let me ask you, are you ready to hear a doctor yell at you?
Do I have to be?
No. I am not going to yell at you.
Of course you are.
I don't yell at people.
You hate people going into the sun, and you even more hate tanning beds.
No, I don't hate tanning beds. Well, tanning beds are different. I don't hate people going into the sun. I go into the sun. But let's look at it. Let's look at what the data is. First of all, is there any such thing as a good tan? And the big answer is no, of course not. But we have to look at where the balance is. Now, let's look at reassurance. Okay, went to the dermatologist, didn't see anything wrong. 50% of all melanoma starts in normal skin with no pre-existing spot. So in other words, if he didn't find or she did not find any spot that was abnormal, that's okay. It doesn't give you much of reassurance because it's only 50%. In other words, you still could have something cooking. What's cooking is most related to the sunburn. In other words, the stuff you got as a kid, when you were out there, I certainly got it. You know, your skin peeled off. I mean, I remember many times peeling off the skin. It was sort of almost like cellophane. Well, that's the stuff that leads to the melanoma more than what you do on the day-to-day basis. So where does it fit? You don't burn. That doesn't give you reassurance you can still get melanoma. You don't have melanoma in your family, I assume, right?
My mother had something removed off of her nose. That was, I guess, suspicious.
But suspicious means it wasn't melanoma. You would know it most likely if she had it, and if not, call her up and say, hey, was it melanoma or not? Because a family history is a big risk factor. So what do? The safest tan is no tan. That's one extreme. That's why people now get sprayed with brown liquid to make them look like they have a tan. That, frankly, is the safest. The worst is to go out in the sun all the time, get burnt, and just like we did as kids, and not really pay any attention at all. You have to find out where the balance is for you. And I I say that to people, and it's a risk, and it's just like a risk of going out in your car. I go out of my car in the wintertime when it's snowing outside and the streets are slippery and I drive and I'm careful. Am I at a higher risk than I am in the summer day in the sun? Absolutely. But that's the risk I want to take. I want to go out. I may want to go to a movie or a show. You are taking a risk. It's there. It's small. It's safer if you don't do it. So you just reduce the risk. I would go out and I wouldn't get a tan all the time. If I were you, I would say, how can I make my skin the color I want it to be, and then not go beyond that?
Mm-hmm. Now, is there a difference between being in the real sun versus in a tanning bed? Because, of course, with the summer almost over here, we don't get a lot of sun in the winter.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, at this point, no difference. Now, the tanning bed people will say, yes, you don't burn, which is true, but it turns out that the risk of basal cell carcinoma, melanoma, black mole, and squamous cell is the same. And the European regulators have just said, there ain't no difference. So my belief now is there ain't no difference. It's exactly the same. So you find your risk, you pick it, and you make your choice. Every time I go in my car, if I use my cell phone, I have a risk. So am I going to use my cell phone? Well, I shouldn't, but sometimes I do, right? And I shouldn't do that because I ought to be perfect. I ought to be paying attention. Mm-hmm. So you pick it. So I didn't yell at you. I just put it into a perspective. Thank you for calling, and thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Sure, we appreciate the call. You were very good, Zorba. You didn't.
So I got a compliment from you. Now, that's one for the year.
The year. I compliment you all the time. Watch this. That was very good, Zorba.
See, that's tough. That's two for the year.
800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. We have callers waiting, but a line is open now for you. As we move along, Zorba, to a listener in Seal Rock, Oregon. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help you?
I am interested in learning more about how salt intake affects blood pressure. My son-in-law tells me the latest research shows it does not have much of an effect, and this goes against everything I was taught as a nurse, and I do a lot of teaching in the home. I'm a home health nurse, so I was wondering if you could tell me more about this.
What did you learn as a nurse, or as preparing to be a nurse, about salt and blood pressure?
That a high salt intake increases your blood pressure because water follows salt, and so you have a tendency to hold on to fluids more, and then this can lead to problems with your heart, with stroke, all kinds of things, complications.
Can I ask how long ago you
was I a nurse? I going through training?
Yeah.
20 years ago.
But you continuously train, Tom. It's not as if you learn things and then you become a nurse and you stop reading.
I'm looking online now at some of.
There was a little implication that it was that what were you trained with, and then what's going on now. But I think you bring up a good point. What's old stuff and what's new stuff? That point is good. What's your son-in-law do?
He teaches at A&M University. He teaches economics.
Economics. So, and he obviously reads a lot.
He does a lot of research. Yeah. He's a smart guy. So I thought, well, I better find out what's the latest. I might be teaching people the wrong thing.
You know, with economists, they say if you get 10 economists in the room, you'll get 15 opinions.
I think that's true.
So let's talk about salt. Salt's an issue. It's a big issue, and there's a big question. First of all, 20% of the population with high blood pressure is salt sensitive. 20%. 80% are not. So with 20% of the people, if you reduce the salt dramatically, you may control their blood pressure. And you can't tell who they are until you have high blood pressure and you go to a super low salt diet and see what it does to your pressure. Now, most people cannot follow a super low salt diet, but most people can reduce their salt. So part of a plan for people who have significant high blood pressure who are not controlled on medication or want to do without medication is, hey, let's see if you're salt sensitive. By the way, the same is true of alcohol. About 20% of the population cannot tolerate a drink. If they have a beer, their blood pressure will go up. And if they don't have any alcohol at all, their blood pressure is fine. So 20% is salt sensitive and probably the same amount alcohol sensitive. Now, the real issue is, does an increased salt intake cause high blood pressure? That's the million-dollar question, because we eat lots of salt in our society. You know, every time I open up a book on nutrition, it says Americans should cut their salt in half. And I thought, well, who invented this number? Where is it cut it in half? Who says we need less salt? Well, that answer has not come out yet. We don't know whether a high salt diet puts pressure on our kidneys to work harder and then ultimately produces high blood pressure. So you can't answer that question. And that's why we've got 10 economists with 15 opinions. Yeah. We can't answer that. So the answer to your son-in-law's is this. Reduce the salt because we think that's good, but we don't really know. If you're going to cook with salt, just don't use a lot. And tend to use salt on the surface of your food because that's where you taste it. You taste it when you take a spoon and you put it in your food. The salt that's on top of the food touches our tongue and gives us the salty taste. So I tell people, don't cook with a lot of salt in your food and put it on top of your food.
That's great advice. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for your call.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 800-462-7413. Well, now, Zorba, as you know, I'm a macho man, so am I going to live a long time or not?
You are a macho man who finally decided to start exercising. No, but wait a minute. You got a motorcycle, right?
Yeah.
Got a motorcycle?
Yeah.
Used to smoke pipes, right?
Well, there's nothing macho about pipes.
Well, no, pipe is not macho.
No, it isn't.
Had to be cigarettes, wouldn't it? It had to be a cigar. Smoke a pipe and a cigar years ago. But this was a very interesting study. Looking at macho men, looking at guys who really consider themselves to be macho. Now, we know that earlier on in life, i.e. high school, macho men tend to attract pretty girls. So we know from an evolutionary point of view, being macho may attract pretty girls. That allows you to reproduce and is better evolutionary from an evolutionary point of view. But what about from a longevity point of view? If people rate themselves on a macho scale, guys, and there are macho scales, believe it or not. There's a scale for everything in America, and there is a macho scale. And basically, the more macho you are, the less likely you are to get a physical examination, about 26% less likely. Less likely to have a prostate examination because no macho man wants a doctor to take their finger and examine their prostate. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
And 50% likely to even do any preventive care at all.
Yeah.
So being, quote, macho may actually be bad for your health and may be part of the reason why women live to 80 years of age and men live to 75 years of age. It's the macho men that are dragging down our states.
I don't know if this study showed it, but I'll bet you they're less likely to have a healthy diet, too.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Now, in fact, many, many macho jobs, machine operators, truck drivers, construction workers, they're less likely to be educated, less likely to have education. And we know that education is a key issue for longevity, that the more educated you are up to 2 years post-high school, the more likely you are to take evasive action when it comes to your health and try to keep your health well. But I think it's from a public health point of view, it says, well, wait a minute, well, your public health announcements that are on TV, are you looking and trying to identify the right people that you're hitting your public health with?
And if you know a macho man or maybe are married to or are going with a macho man.
Or are a macho man.
Well, maybe a good idea to start looking at some of these lifestyle things and say, hey, maybe I really ought to take more care of my health. I can still be a tough guy, but I can also be a smart guy at the same time.
Right, right. Now, it was very interesting in this because one of the macho jobs that they looked at were truck drivers. We have lots and lots of truckers who listen to us on the show.
Yeah, we do.
We have calls all the time from truckers. And so truckers, even though they may be macho, are public radio listeners, and then they're much more likely to take care of their health. So I don't think it's all macho men. I'm going to take the truckers out because there are a lot of truckers who are public radio listeners. Go and keep on listening to public radio and learn about your health.
You can even call public radio, 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba may be able to answer, probably will be able to answer your question. 800-462-7413. Here's a listener now, Zorba, in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Hello.
Hello, Tom. I have a health question that I've researched online and found nothing.
Hmm?
So what do you do? Call Dr. Zorba.
Of course.
Several years ago, I inherited from my grandparents a set of lead crystal decanters for storing liquor. And a few months ago, my older brother and younger brother were visiting. They're both engineers. And they were shocked to find that I was actually using them. And they pointed out that lead crystal is over 20% lead content, and led me to believe that this might be dangerous. Of course, I don't know whether they were just kidding me or not, because they know that I'm a liberal arts major and stupid in math.
I can identify with
but
that.
But when it comes to style, you've got the lead crystal, and they're drinking out of plastic.
That's right.
And so I was wondering if there might be any validity to their claim that I am slowly poisoning myself by using occasionally, one or two times a week, liquor from these decanters in order to mix a drink.
By the way, the question is a great question. Lead pipe, that's where we go back to. We know that lead pipe is available lead. And the amount of lead in water going through lead pipe when you're drinking lots of water, and there's lots of old lead pipe around the country. It was used, for instance, in Madison, Wisconsin. They're replacing it because it was used to go in and out of houses 100 years ago. And if we look at the lead pipe and the amount of lead in there, it's infinitesimally small for people who are drinking water out of lead pipes that are going to their house. So we know the lead is more available out of the pipe, and we know that they're drinking a lot more water than you are alcohol. So from a point of view of that, we can look back and see, is there any danger? And it turns out the danger is probably zero. It's close to zero in lead pipe, except for growing children, young children. That's the real issue. Young children whose brains are developing. We don't know whether or not there's a risk with lead pipes in water that goes to your house. Now, let's go to lead crystal. A, we don't have young children who are drinking. You're not giving them rum out of your decanters. So we can take that away from that. But the data shows when you look at it, there's no evidence that there's actually lead in the wine. When they've actually tested the wine, the EPA has said there is no lead that we can find in the wine. So you weren't able to find information, but let me assure you from the best data I have that you can have your glass of rum and Coke or a brandy old-fashioned sweet or whatever you drink, you can have that out of your lead crystal, and I don't think you're getting any lead at all.
Well, that's great news. Thanks, Dr. Zorba.
You're welcome. Now, what do your brothers like to drink?
They drink just whatever I prepare. And I tend to fix rum and Coke, as you mentioned, and in the summer I like gin and tonic. And those are the only two decanters that I tend to use. And then the others, I just don't store anything in them because I feel like since they wouldn't be used on a regular basis, there might be a bigger chance, you know, of them having a higher lead content.
Well, enjoy your time with your brothers, and with your liberal arts background, make sure you continue to show them style.
Mm-hmm. With lead water on the rock.
Gosh. That's why you're here, Tom, to keep the whole thing straight as an arrow.
Thanks for the call. Before the break, Zorba, let's see if we can help out a smoker named Mark. Mark writes, as a regular listener to your show, I hear the constant discussions and warnings regarding cigarette smoking. I've struggled with this addiction for years and have made progress in cutting down, but have been unable to quit entirely. I wonder if there isn't some sort of argument that could be made concerning how much a person actually smokes. If one smokes half a pack a day, are the health effects the same as someone who smokes two packs a day?
Well, the answer is yes. There is a good argument. The more you smoke, the greater the risk. So if you cut down to three cigarettes, you've cut your risk dramatically. You haven't cut it out completely. And so we say don't smoke at all because it's always a toxin. But the fact is, yes, if you're down to three cigarettes a day, you're far better than if you were smoking three packs a day. No doubt about it. From a public health point of view, we don't talk about that. And the reason is a lot of people who go down to three a day go back up to a pack a day. So it's not good public health information. But yeah, Mark, if you can't quit, if you go down to three a day, that's great. But zero is much, much better than even three.
Well, he didn't say three. He said half a pack.
Half a pack is still quite a bit. Yeah. Half a pack is quite a bit. Two or three cigarettes a day, the risk is there. Half a pack is a significant risk. It's quite high. quite high. So you don't get kudos. You don't get kudos for half a pack.
Hey, but way to go in cutting back. Now keep on going.
Huh? That's right. Keep on going. Try to get down to three a day and you'll be better.
Mm-hmm. If you have a lifestyle question for the show, we want to hear it. Send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Ready to lick your lips. We have our recipe coming up. Lots more of your calls at 800-462-7413. Some more research and later on our medical myth buster. All right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again is 800-462-7413. Callers waiting, but a line open now for you at 1-800-462-7413. Before we get back to the phone, Zorba, recipe time. This one for grilled chicken with fruit salsa.
Does that sound good to you?
It does.
You like chicken.
I do.
I happen to like chicken. And the thing about boneless, skinless chicken breasts is if you don't do something with them, they're tasteless. I mean, they have a texture to them, and they have a nice firmness to them. But you have to do something because chicken skin, when it's fried, tastes good. I think it tastes really good. And when you don't have the skin on it, what are you going to do to give it moisture and texture and taste? And the answer is you want to marinate it and put stuff on top of it to make it moist. Yes, you're cooking it.
And that's what we're talking about here.
That's exactly it. Yeah. So first of all, let's talk about the chicken, what we're going to do with chicken. Start out with 3 tablespoonfuls of olive oil.
3 big T olive oil.
That's right. I always use extra virgin in everything. Some people say, well, you don't need it really for cooking. You just need to have that more expensive olive oil for a salad. But
Is there anything that uses olive oil that you would say don't use extra virgin?
No, I like extra virgin.
That's the preference for everything.
That's right. And I get my olive oil over the net, and I have a little olive oil company that I use outside of California. It'll be on our website. I love it. And by the way, I don't own any stock in the olive oil on the website.
Okay.
But I love extra virgin olive oil, and I search around for it, and that's where I get mine.
Mm-hmm.
2 tablespoonfuls of dry white wine.
2 big T dry white wine.
That's right. And on the whole, I use vermouth. That's what I do. It lasts. It's in the house. It's cheap. It's inexpensive. And from Cook's Illustrated years ago, I saw it as a tip. And that's my, whenever it's white wine, I use vermouth.
Yeah.
It's
now, great. If I did this, used an expensive white wine, could anybody tell the difference?
No, not at all. And the fact is, if you're going to have it that night, you might as well open up your bottle of wine and just use
that. Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right.
That's
it. You're just talking about 2 tablespoons.
Yeah, that's not very much. 2 tablespoonfuls of fresh lime juice.
2 big T. Fresh lime juice.
That's right. Do not use reconstituted. It's not as bright. It's not as treble, as I call it.
Treble.
It just doesn't.
That's good.
A tablespoonful of white wine Worcestershire sauce. It's different from the regular Worcestershire sauce. White wine Worcestershire sauce.
A big T. White wine Worcestershire, which I can't pronounce.
Worcestershire. 1.5 teaspoons of dried basil.
1.5 teaspoons dried basil.
That's right, dried basil spice, and 4 boneless skinless chicken breasts.
Mm-hmm. 4 boneless chicken breast halves.
Okay. Now, let's talk about the salsa, and then we'll talk about the prep.
Yeah.
Salsa, 2 large peaches, firm and ripe.
2 large peaches, ripe and firm.
That's
right. This season, at least in our neighborhood, it's hard to get good peaches for some reason.
That's right. Well, it all depends on the time of the year, where you are, how close you are to Georgia, which, of course, is the peach state.
We were talking about that. We had a little family gathering, and people brought peaches. You can't get good peaches this year.
Where we are, or right now.
Now,
in Lexington, Kentucky, I bet they have really good peaches because they're closer, because they grow a lot of peaches down there. But you could use canned peaches. They won't be quite as firm. Mm-hmm. And if you buy it, you want to buy the canned peaches in water. And if it's the canned peaches, which happen to be in a heavy syrup, wash off the syrup. You don't want all that sugary syrup on there.
Oh, okay.
One small Granny Smith apple peeled, cored, and chopped.
A small Granny Smith apple peeled, cored, and chopped. Why Granny Smith?
It's tart. It's tart. Mm-hmm. It's tart. And Red Delicious is not delicious.
Oh, yeah, right.
Red Delicious look red, and they're not delicious. A small jalapeno sliced, mm-hmm. or diced, rather.
A small jalapeno diced.
Yes. And you like jalapeno? You like
it? Anything spicy.
Yeah. So, you know, you can make it one of those really hot ones. What are those really hottest peppers?
I don't know what the pepper scale is
from 1 to 10. I once made a recipe at home, and it was so hot that when Penny had her first taste of it, she said, oh, my gosh, her eyes opened up and her contacts popped out.
Oh, come on.
It's it. I gave her a hot sauce, and she loves hot food, and it was hotter than she could stand. Really, we found one of the contacts, but the other one... we never found. Anyway, 1/2 cup of chopped fresh cilantro.
A cup of chopped fresh cilantro.
If you don't like cilantro, and some people do, some people don't, use parsley. Use parsley. Uh-huh. It won't have the taste uh-huh. of cilantro, uh-huh. but it will have the green. Uh-huh. 1.5 tablespoonfuls of honey.
1.5 big tea honey.
Yeah. By the way, Tom, I was just up in Minocqua, Wisconsin, talking, and when I said Tom, somebody looked at me and they said, oh, big tea, little tea. That's what he said, big T, little T, this guy. Yeah. But actually, you're taller than I am, so you must be big T and I must be little T.
No.
Let's see. So where? Okay, 1.5 tablespoonfuls of honey. I think I said that, but
yeah.
I'm going to say it
yeah.
again. 2 tablespoonfuls of fresh lime juice. We did that already, that I know.
2 big T,
that's
fresh,
right, fresh lime juice. Oh, no, we did that before. So more lime juice. 1/4 teaspoon of ground allspice.
1/4 little T, ground allspice.
And 1/4 teaspoon of cinnamon.
1/4 little tea cinnamon.
Okay, so let's do the chicken. Mix the oil, white wine, lime juice, Worcestershire sauce, and basil in a large bowl. Add the chicken breast, coat to cover even, cover and refrigerate at least 1 hour. You can do it the night before if you want to. Now let's prepare the salsa. You're eating it. How do you like it?
It was delicious, obviously. Really,
you can't
spicy.
Stop
Tastes
eating,
great.
Folks. Big T is eating all he can eat of that
spicy
salsa.
Spicy fruit, that's really good.
He loves it. So the salsa, bring a medium saucepan of water to a boil over medium heat. Add the peaches and boil for about 30 seconds, just a slight boil. Using a slotted spoon, transfer the peaches to a bowl of cold water, so instantly in cold water. Drain it, peel, and chop coarsely. One of the reasons that you're putting it instantly in cold water and it should be icy is it's easier to peel the peach when you actually do that. Then place the peaches in a large bowl, mix in all the remaining ingredients, cover and chill. You could do that an hour before and you could do it the day before, but if so, put the saran wrap on top of it to make sure you keep away the oxygen. Then prepare a grill or a broiler. Remove the chicken from the marinade and broil it or grill it until it's cooked thoroughly. That's until the inside is 185 degrees on an instant read thermometer. If you don't have one, buy one. You need it. That's about 6 minutes. And then put the chicken breast on the plate, top with the salsa, invite your friends over, and enjoy. It's only 300 calories, folks.
Mm-hmm.
300 calories, hardly any fat, and lots of deliciousness.
You give your recipe a taste there, as you know. It is delicious. Really interesting.
Oh, my gosh, that's so lovely.
Man, yeah, I'm just trying to imagine this on chicken, and I think it would be very, very good. Adam, thanks so much for making this salsa for us. And if you'd like this recipe,
go to the web at ZorbaPastor.org. You can look at this recipe, search for our archives for other fine recipes, and sign up for our weekly podcast. That's ZorbaPastor.org.
1-800-462-7413. That's a toll-free number. And if you have a question for Zorba, you'll want to give it a call. 1-800-462-7413. Here's a listener with us now, Zorba, in Spring Green, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Fine.
Enjoying the recipe, are you?
Yes,
How can we help you?
Yes. The reason I was calling is I wanted to ask Zorba something. First of all, I presume you have some Greek heritage to you.
There's a drop or two of Greek blood, yes.
Okay. And the second thing is that, well, I grew up in a community called Mobile, Alabama, which is down on the Gulf Coast.
That's funny. I thought from the way you're talking that you were a native Wisconsinite.
Southern Wisconsin. But I've been here 23 years. I used to have an accent.
Yeah, you're shaking that accent. That's great.
But we have a very large Greek community. In fact, my ex-wife was half Greek and half Italian. I happen to be all Irish, so you can imagine how my kids turned out. But one thing that we do down there is you guys use vinegar in everything. I listen to you guys every week. In that particular part of the country, we use citrus for flavor.
Oh.
If you're using making a salad dressing, it's not organic vinegar, volganic. I'm like you now. I'm having a little trouble pronouncing. But we use citrus and olive oil. We use a lot of garlics, a lot of olive oils, but we use citrus. And I was wondering, do you think that just got passed on because citrus was plentiful down there, or do you because of the health?
You know, when you look at regional differences with food, it really tends to do with what the heritage is that comes in, and then what you can grow. There are a variety of things, and then health is really secondary. So you look at Wisconsin, you know, they don't use citrus. We use vinegar and have a lot of sauerkraut. Well, you don't, if you want good sauerkraut, you come to Wisconsin, but you certainly don't go to Mobile, Alabama.
Right.
And in Wisconsin, you go to the grocery stores and you'll see kraut juice. And when I brought it to my cousin in California, I said, you got to try this. It's called kraut juice. She looked at it and promptly threw it in the garbage can. She said, I am not going to eat that kraut juice. I don't like sauerkraut. It's too spicy for me. But you look at citrus. Yes, it's a thing. It's so plentiful in the South. It has a bright texture and flavor. But it'll also have a lot of vitamin C.
Yeah.
And the fact is, vinegar does not have any vitamin C in it to speak of. It's wine vinegar and apple cider vinegar and rice wine vinegar and a whole bunch of balsamic vinegar. You know, there are so many different vinegars, but they have absolutely no vitamin C in it all. So in the end, the citrus certainly gives you a little bit of vitamin C, which is very, very good for your health. But I don't think they decided to use it because it was good for their health. I think the cooks did it because it tasted good, mm-hmm. and it was cheap, it was inexpensive, and it was plentiful. And besides, what are you going to do for the stuff? You can only eat so much fresh citrus, and then what are you going to do with it? You got to make it into something to store it, and that's where the sauces came from.
Yeah, let me. Can I give you a quick recipe to try?
Sure.
Let me give you a way to prepare coleslaw that is so different, because one thing we keep away from a lot of the heavy sauces down there, and I think it has to do with the heat and digestion and things like this. Get your cabbage, cut your cabbage, but instead of putting a coleslaw dressing on it, and you're going to love this, Alba, use extra virgin olive oil, lemon juice, and believe it or not, just some celery salt. That's the recipe.
That's all. Just a little celery salt. Little lemon juice.
Or lime. And olive
and
oil.
And some olive oil. I got to try that.
Now, in Georgia, they take a little bit of horseradish.
Ooh.
And mix it in.
Ooh. I like that.
It's really good. It's very refreshing. It cleans the palate, believe it or not. It's really a delicious dish. And there again, the lime and the lemon juice comes in. The other thing I wanted to tell you, and then I'll let you go, mm-hmm. is you're mentioning Georgia peaches. The best peaches in the country actually come from a county right across the border from Georgia. They're called Chilton County peaches. And if I go to Mobile again in the near future, because peaches are in, I'll bring you back and drop off some Chilton County peaches.
Oh, we would love it.
They
we would
are
love
absolutely
it.
Delicious. But if you go to the store down there, you can get Georgia peaches. But you get Chilton County, they're going to cost you a dollar more a pound.
That's great.
Well, thanks, guys. That's what I'm just wondering why people didn't use more citrus up here. I still do, and everything I cook.
Some great suggestions.
The show, and I'm just wondering, everybody uses vinegar up here, and so you probably explained to me the reason why.
Well, thanks for your call.
We appreciate it a lot. You know, when I was a kid, my mom used to, this is the salad that I would have with my main course. The salad would be lettuce
mm-hmm. okay.
with lemon juice on it.
Oh, that's what your mom used to serve?
Yeah.
Salt? Instead of, any salt or anything?
No, Just lemon juice. It was good.
It was good.
Yeah. You know, as he was saying, a nice citrus, and that's all you need.
Yeah. Now, my mom would serve salad with mayonnaise and ketchup. She mixed it together. So that's what she did. Shows the difference.
Let's take a moment here to check in on the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox now for another edition of Disagreeing with the Doc. Today's dissent deals with a recent chat we were having about condiments. More specifically, how ketchup had been surpassed by salsa as the number one condiment in America. A listener named Andy T. sets us straight, quoting, I heard a comment on NPR last week saying, yes, more people spend money on salsa because niche brands can command quite a price versus commercial ketchup. But per volume, ketchup is consumed more.
Per volume. Now, is that the number of bottles of ketchup or
that's
the
total
amount?
The overall
so
amount.
So volume-wise, there's more ketchup consumed.
But more money is spent on salsa.
On salsa. Oh, okay.
That's interesting, isn't it?
It's very interesting. Yeah, because of niche salsa, we don't have niche ketchup, do we?
No, we should.
We don't have niche ketchup. There's not highfalutin ketchup. I'm going to spend $100 on this bottle of ketchup.
No,
that's not
no.
the way it goes.
Well, Andy just wanted to let us know. If you have a bone to pick, send an email to the show for another edition of Disagreeing with the Doc. Just send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have some interesting research coming up. We have more of your calls on our medical myth buster. Lots of great reasons to stay with us here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Want to join us? Have a question for Zorba? Here's the number to call. 1-800-462-7413. Before our next call, Zorba, some interesting research, new research on healthy lifestyles and their positive health effects.
Right. So we know healthy lifestyles count, right? But the real question is, how much do they count?
Yeah.
I mean, how much do you really pay attention to things? And there were four healthy lifestyles that were identified in this study, what I call now the big four, that make a huge difference, it turns out. So these are the four healthy lifestyles. Never smoking.
Mm-hmm.
Never smoking is defined as having 100 cigarettes or less during your lifetime.
Wow. So those of us who have smoked are out of luck.
That's right.
Out of luck on this one.
That's exactly it. So never smoking, out of luck. Number two, maintaining a healthy weight. And maintaining a healthy weight, it basically having a BMI, body mass index, less than 30.
Mm-hmm.
That's roughly what it is.
Well, most of us have no idea what our body mass
index is. Well, you can go online, put in your height and your weight, and you can find out your BMI. You know, your BMI is probably about 25. That's yours, or 24. It's very easy to do. It's a formula, but you go online.
That's it? Just height and weight, and that's it?
Go online, Google BMI, okay, put in your height, put in your weight.
Okay.
There's your BMI. Very simple. Very simple to find out. BMI, less than 30. Doctors often have that in their office. It's used as part of the vital signs when we're identifying that.
Mm-hmm.
So BMI, less than 30. That's the second thing. The third thing is exercising regularly. And exercising regularly was defined as 3.5 hours per week of some exercise activity.
Yeah. Now, is this like smoking? I had to start doing it when I was, you know, young and keep on doing it until I get old?
In this particular study, they were looking at people who are exercising. That's all. It's not smoking, which is a lifelong activity of 100 cigarettes
so
or less.
So currently exercising.
Correct. Currently exercising. And then the fourth one was following healthy dietary principles. In other words, having a diet, high consumption of fruits and veggies, and less meat. Okay. Mm. Now, most participants had one to three of these. You know, 4% of the group, this is a group of about 25,000 Europeans. Okay.
Oh, okay.
So 4% had zero healthy factors. You know, so 5% did nothing. Only 10% of them had all four healthy factors.
I believe that.
Yeah. But so most people had like two or three. Now, they looked at them over an eight-year period. These were more than 2,000 participants, and here's what they found. The people who had all four factors, the big four, had a 78% lower risk of developing major diseases that were chronic diseases such as diabetes, heart disease, stroke, and so on.
78%?
78%. Yeah. In other words, 78% had a lower incidence of diabetes, had a massively lower incidence in heart attack and stroke, and had a lower incidence of cancer, a major thing. So that means if you follow the big four, you will live the long life.
800-462-7413, toll free, 1-800-462-7413. Let's see now, Zorba, if we can help a listener in Bartlesville, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Well, I kind of have a question about, butcher shop meat versus supermarket meat. My husband and I have started trying this experiment where we were buying nothing but butcher shop meat. We have three children with ADHD, and we've noticed a noticeable change in all three of their behaviors. Their attention's better, you know, everything like that. And we've been doing this since the beginning of this month. My question is, what's a difference in the nutritional value? Because I know, like, Walmart meat and, you know, supermarket meats have dyes in them, hormones, steroids, that kind of thing. What's the main nutritional differences in that?
Yeah. What sorts of behavioral changes have you noticed with your kids?
Well, we have a six-year-old daughter who has a little bit of anger management issues.
Mm-hmm.
And that's gone way down. And the other two, they're able to focus better. But just different little changes. You know, they focus better. They're more energetic.
And you've
in a good way.
And you've noticed this just in the last, you just made this switch just in the last few weeks?
Yeah.
Hmm. Well, first of all, if we look at the difference in meat, it's really not butcher shop meat versus, you know, we'll say supermarket meat. There are differences in having organic beef, for example, having beef that's on range-fed cattle. That might be an example versus corn-fed beef. And there's a question of whether or not what the nutritional difference is. Generally, feedlot beef is going to be, on the whole, have more fat in it. But beyond that, even though feedlot beef versus organic beef is using antibiotics, and there may be trace amounts of antibiotics in the beef itself, and that's sort of arguable, but it may be there or not. I don't know if there's really much of a nutritional difference. Now, the real issue is that you're now serving different beef to your family. So what you may be doing is acting differently with your kids. In other words, in the food prep and how you're acting, how you're sitting down, what are you doing? Are you having a family meal now together and treating it as more of a special time?
Yes and no. I pretty much prep it the same way, you know, and they are in the same way. It's just, you know, they went with us to the butcher shop, you know, and they actually saw the cow hanging up, which I thought I was going to have three vegetarians for a while after that.
But you see that? You bring up a very good point, and that may be part of it. One of the ways to get kids interested in fruits and vegetables is you go out, they pick out the fruits and vegetables, and then they prepare them with you at home. So
yeah.
You took your kids, you went to the butcher shop, they saw a carcass there, they talked to the butcher, they went through a whole series of things, which is totally different than going to Walmart and picking out a piece of plastic with some beef inside.
Mm-hmm.
And that particular aspect of it is probably what changed the behavior with your children.
Really?
Yeah, with your kids. And so my recommendation is that cook with your kids. Cook with your kids, plan the meals with the kids, and have your kids try to make a meal for you at least once a week. Now, the meal for you might be very minimal. It doesn't matter. But I think meals with kids are really a critical issue. They're critically important. And I think that's what's going on. I think it was the process that made the difference. And that's what I would keep on doing with your kids. I think that'll help.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. And thanks so much for the call.
You doubt if there's any real difference in the meat itself.
I don't think so. Well, there's difference in meat between organic meat and you know, and free-range beef versus corn-fed beef in a lot. You can argue what they are, but there are differences. I mean, one's organic and one isn't organic. Yeah. Whether you get it at a butcher shop or whether you get it at a store such as Whole Foods or Trader Joe's or something, I don't think that makes much of a difference, but the beef does. Now, how it relates to ADHD, I doubt if ADHD is affected. I don't think it's like the sugar issue with ADHD. But going with your kids, preparing things, working with them, that's a big difference. That's good parenting.
Yeah. 800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. Well, Zorba, we've reached the time in the show for our medical myth buster. We have a listener myth today from a listener in Knoxville, Tennessee, that deals with the difference between farm-raised and wild salmon. They write, "It is my understanding that omega-3 fatty acids are prevalent in wild salmon as well as other selected marine fish, but not in farm-raised salmon. The reason is that fatty acids accumulate in the various organisms that are in the food chain of fish like salmon, but there is no similar food chain in farm-raised salmon, so the concentration of omega-3s is either very low or even zero. Is this a myth?"
Yes, that is a myth. There are differences between farm-raised salmon and and salmon that you catch that are wild salmon, but it is a myth because what happens is salmon manufactures its own omega-3 fatty acids. You don't eat it and it goes through unchanged and then gets plopped as fat in the fish. It's not really that simple, but there are distinct differences there. It turns out that farm-raised fish is fatter, and the reason why it's fatter is it doesn't have to move around as much, so on the farm, so it tends to actually have more fat. Aqua farming has its own issues because they use antibiotics and they often use pesticides and other things within them. So it has, you know, there are other issues. Of course, when you're in a free-range environment, you don't have those issues.
Right.
And so there are a number of environmental concerns. And then the question is whether or not, you know, the farm-raised salmon, they actually feed them a dye to make it turn salmon pink. And otherwise, it would be sort of a disgusting gray. Now, is there a difference in the omega-3 fatty acids? I don't think there's any good scientific study that shows there's a difference between one versus another. There may be a difference because the salmon doesn't move as much.
Yeah.
So there may be a difference in the type of omega-3 fatty acids. The fact is there are a couple of real differences. There's a difference in price, which is why people tend to buy farm-raised salmon versus wild salmon. Yeah,
there certainly is a difference in taste.
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt about it. No doubt about it. My daughter now lives in Seattle. I've got good friends in Seattle. When I go there, they say, "Hey, you've got to try the Copper River salmon. It's really running." I get a taste of that and I go, "Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
This is a totally different salmon." So from a taste point of view, hands down, wild salmon over farm-raised salmon. From an omega-3 fatty acid point of view, well, there are issues here, but they're environmental issues more than nutritional issues.
If you have a myth you'd like Zorba to bust, send it to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
800-462-7413, toll free. A listener now, Zorba, in Waupaca, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Well, I've got a question regarding multivitamins.
Mm-hmm.
I've been taking a multivitamin, a generic over-the-counter multivitamin, for a number of years, and recently read some information about pharmaceutical grade and comparing that to a product that I'm taking now. So I guess my question is before I spend probably five times the amount of what I'm spending now on multivitamins, I just want to know, is there a value for me to make that change?
What can you say what you're taking right now? What product?
Yeah, like a Centrum type product.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Like see on the grocery shelf.
Yeah.
Well, Zorba, Zorba, that the more you pay, the better it is. Right?
Yeah, right. Right. That's the American way. If you're going to spend $25 to $30 a month on a vitamin, it must be better. It must be better. Well, vitamins are regulated in a very special way by the FDA. So they're regulated like a drug. If it says USP, which means U.S. Pharmacopoeia, and it has to meet certain standards, it has to dissolve within a certain amount of time in the stomach. These standards have to be proven, and the vitamin has to be able to get out into the bloodstream. So the reality is if it says multivitamin with minerals, USP, and it costs $5 or $10 for 100 tablets, you can buy the same thing for $30 to $40. $15, and there ain't no difference. There ain't no difference. Now, there are people who say, well, wait a minute. There really is a difference. We can show this because the vitamin that you take at the store, sometimes if you look at your poop, you'll see it in there. Well, what happens is some of the vitamins have what's called a skeleton, and the vitamin attaches to the skeleton, and it can pass, the skeleton may pass unchanged through the digestive tract, but the vitamin actually has leached out. Because it, if it says USP, it reaches those standards. So I tell people all the time, do not spend your money on vitamins. Don't spend it. Don't waste your money. Spend it on fruits and vegetables. If you're going to go spend your money, that's where you get your biggest bang for your buck. So I'm not big on boutique vitamins. I think that I don't like to spend my money on that. I'd rather spend it on something else. And I buy, you know, there's certain things that I buy that are classier than others, but it's not when it's in the vitamin shelf. You've been taking a vitamin for a long time?
Probably about 5 or 6 years now.
Okay, so you take a multivitamin with minerals. Anything else besides that?
No.
Okay, my recommendation is you also take vitamin D, and it should say vitamin D3. That's what it should say. 1,000 to 2,000 units. That's what you need. There's not enough vitamin D in a multivitamin. The feds are now looking at it to see whether or not they should change the vitamin D levels. So I recommend a multivitamin and vitamin D3, 1,000 to 2,000 units, at least 1,000 a day.
Okay. Anything in addition to that? Some of the other information that I had read was on recommended daily allowances, that they really are just minimums.
Well, they are minimums. That's exactly what they are. That's what you need. That's a minimal amount. Get your vitamins through fruits and veggies. That's what I recommend. Colorful plate, lots of different fruits and veggies, because, you know, Mother Nature manufactures things completely differently than the pharmaceutical industry. They manufacture what will sell, and Mother Nature manufactures what we like to taste. So spend your money on mama, not on the pharma industry.
Great. Thank you very much.
Sure. We appreciate the call. Thank you. We're almost out of time, Zorba, but before we leave, we have an email from Jeff in Mount Horeb, Wisconsin, policing the Zorba Pastor on Your Health Grammar Police. Perhaps that makes Jeff part of the Zorba Pastor on Your Health Grammar Police Internal Affairs Unit. Deputy Jeff is chiming in on our bring versus take case, and he writes, given the recent discussion of the grammar behind bringing something to and taking something away, as our previous deputy suggested, should the famous doctor joke punchline then become, bring two aspirin and call me in the morning? I don't think so. But if you'd like to join the Zorba Pastor on Your Health Grammar Police or defend Zorba from false charges, send your email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week.
Take care, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
Don't forget, you can call us day or night at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tango and Cash, otherwise known as Brad Kohlberg and Adam Friedrich, help us put the hour together each week. Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich, and our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, expecting your company on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.